Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Pope and St. Albert. Pope Benedict looks at the figure of the 13th century theologian and doctor of the Church, St. Albert the Great, during his Wednesday general audience. Remembering Romero. On the Church's Day for honouring missionary martyrs, we examine the life and legacy of one of Christianity's most revered modern-day martyrs, Archbishop Romero of San Salvador, who was shot dead while celebrating Mass 30 years ago today. And Gabriel's News. We take a closer look at the importance and history of Thursday's Feast of the Annunciation, when the angel Gabriel revealed to Our Lady that she was to become the mother of Jesus, and the insight this event sheds on the figure of Mary. Here in the Vatican, Pope Benedict looked at the figure of the 13th century theologian and doctor of the Church, St. Albert the Great, during his Wednesday general audience. Chris Altieri reports.
St. Albert the Great was one of the greatest teachers of the Middle Ages. He is most well known as the teacher of St. Thomas Aquinas, though as Pope Benedict noted in his remarks on Wednesday during the weekly general audience, St. Albert was a universal genius whose interests ranged from the natural sciences to philosophy and theology.
Albert entered the Dominicans and, after studies in Paris, taught in Cologne. Elected provincial of the Teutonic province, he served as Bishop of Regensburg for 4 years and then returned to teaching and writing. He played an important part in the Council of Lyons, and he worked to clarify and defend the teaching of St. Thomas Aquinas, his most brilliant student.
Pope Pius XI canonized Albert and declared him a doctor of the Church, while Pope Pius XII named him the patron of the natural sciences.
St. Albert shows us that faith is not opposed to reason, and that the created world can be seen as a book written by God and capable of being read in its own way by the various sciences. His study of Aristotle also brought out the difference between the sciences of philosophy and theology, while insisting that both cooperate in enabling us to discover our vocation to truth and happiness, a vocation which finds its fulfillment in eternal life.
Pope Benedict also recalled Thursday's Solemnity of the Annunciation, saying that the mystery of the Incarnation reveals the particular value and dignity of human life. In Polish language remarks, Pope Benedict said, life is a gift from God, and that we have a duty to safeguard it from conception until natural death. The Holy Father said he wholeheartedly joins himself to all those who work toward fostering respect for life. I'm Chris Altieri.
A martyr and a beacon of moral courage. That's how many people in El Salvador and beyond describe the figure of Archbishop Oscar Romero of San Salvador, who was shot dead 30 years ago today while celebrating Mass. Since his brutal murder on March the 24th, 1980, millions of Christians around the world of all denominations have come to recognize Romero as a modern-day martyr. The late Pope John Paul prayed at Romero's tomb, and Pope Benedict has said that it's his hope that the servant of God will soon be beatified. Romero's assassination came after he spoke out on numerous occasions against grave human rights violations committed during his nation's bloody civil war. Thousands of people were being seized and killed by death squads at that time, and in his Sunday homilies, Archbishop Romero documented the murders and disappearances of the previous week and condemned repression by El Salvador's ruling military junta. In February 1980, Archbishop Romero wrote to the US administration asking it to reconsider its offer of aid to the junta. And on March the 23rd, he appealed to Salvadorian soldiers to stop killing their own people. One day later, he was shot dead, and nobody has ever been brought to justice for the crime. Father Michael Campbell Johnson is a Jesuit priest who spent over 10 years in El Salvador during the 1980s and met Romero, who was also a Jesuit, before his appointment as Archbishop. I began by asking Father Michael to assess the strength of Romero's legacy in El Salvador 30 years after his assassination.
Well, my reply to that question will be an unusual one. I think their devotion to the memory and presence of Archbishop Romero has grown in the past 30 years. It's now shared by almost everyone in El Salvador. One of the reasons is that he was such a simple and humble man, and he was not only in touch with the poor, but he learnt from them. A recent book that's been published precisely for the 30th anniversary makes a point that Romero's life was very similar to that of Jesus of Nazareth. They were both born in conditions of poverty in the province of a small and very insignificant country. They both lived a life of intimacy with God and prayed by night. They both learned the trade of a carpenter, and they both took sides with the poor, and so on and so on. And it ends by saying, they both confronted the imperialist powers of their day, and their public life lasted a mere 3 years. So I think that's one of the main reasons why there's so much devotion to him today. And finally, I would say that his message is still needed today. There are still many more poor people in El Salvador than there even were in probably his time. And his message of justice and against corruption is still needed today. And I think the people in El Salvador are very much aware of that.
Archbishop Romero was possessed of many gifts as a pastor, but according to Father Michael, it was his extraordinary courage that really stood out.
Well, I think it was his courage, and also the fact that he, I'm careful to use this word, underwent a conversion when he became archbishop. As I'm sure you know, he wasn't the main choice of many people in El Salvador. Neither the nuncio nor the previous archbishop wanted him. They wanted somebody else, because Romero had the reputation of being very timid and also very passive and not very much concerned about the poor. But then, right at the beginning of his time as archbishop, he underwent a sort of conversion, though he himself didn't like that expression. He said, what really happened, I went back to my roots and found my roots again among the poor. The thing that really caused this was the assassination of Father Rutilio Grandi, a Jesuit who was working in a rural area. Romero knew him well, and he went down to El Paisnal on the night of his assassination and spent the whole night there, kneeling in the church before his body and listening to the peasants, the campesinos, about their problems and trying to decide what he should do as archbishop. And that night, I think, had an enormous effect on his life, because he went back to town and he decided on a number of things. The two perhaps most important were not to have any relations with the president or the government until a proper investigation had been carried out into Rutilio Grandi's assassination. And the second one was he decided to suppress all masses in the capital the following Sunday and just have one mass in the cathedral, to which he invited everyone. The apostolic nuncio said to him, "You can't do that." He said, "I am archbishop, and this is what I'm going to do." So he was a very different man after that experience. And I think that affected the rest of his pastoral ministry, because he realized very clearly, ever more clearly, he had to speak out against the injustice, even if he would eventually suffer for it. And I think he knew perfectly well that he would suffer, and that eventually he would have to die for what he was doing.
So what then were his most famous remarks? Father Michael again.
Well, I suppose the best known is a reply he made to a Mexican journalist just 2 weeks before his assassination, because the Mexican journalist asked him if he was afraid of death. And he said, "Yes, I'm afraid of death, but I have trust in Jesus Christ. And if I die, I will come alive again in the hearts of the Salvadorans." And that, of course, is exactly what has happened. There's a biography of him which is called "The Word Remains." And that means his word, his sermon, remains today very important for El Salvador, because it was not his word, but the word of God.
The move to have Romero beatified is proving a long and complicated process. But Father Michael says that for many people in El Salvador, he is already a saint in their eyes.
Well, it is a long process, and I think the first thing one has to remember is the ordinary people have canonized him already. They're not waiting for the church, but they are anxious that the church pronounces and calls him a saint. Two of the people in El Salvador today who are pushing this very strongly is the new president of the republic, Mauricio Funes, and also the archbishop. And they have both appealed to the Vatican to move on with his cause, because all the initial work has already been done. All the documents are in the Vatican. He's already officially a venerable servant of the church, which means that the beatification process is sort of halfway.
Nobody has ever been brought to trial for Archbishop Romero's murder, even though a UN Truth Commission concluded that the former Death Squad leader Roberto d'Aubuisson had ordered his killing. But why is that? And is there a lot of anger in El Salvador about this failure to apprehend and punish the killers?
Yes, nobody has been brought to trial. This is mainly because the government has prevented this. Now, I think with the new government now and the new president of the republic, which represents the other side, if you like, what used to be the FMLN, the rebel side, this may now change, and there may be a proper inquiry into his death and a proper trial. But this may or may not happen. The people feel it should happen, so maybe something will happen now.
Father Michael met Romero whilst he was still a bishop and told me what his impressions of him were like in that period.
Well, I mentioned already the sort of conversion that he seems to have gone through when he first became archbishop, because before that he was a very quiet and rather timid man. And when I met him some years back before he became archbishop, he was then bishop in Santiago de Maria, I was with him in a meeting with a number of other bishops, and he hardly spoke. He hardly played any part in the meeting at all, and seemed very withdrawn into himself and very quiet. And this was the reputation he had, and it was precisely because of this that many people didn't really want him to become archbishop in San Salvador. So he was timid and a very quiet man, and also had the reputation of being very conservative in his views. Well, when I speak about his conversion, this obviously changed.
He was very outspoken, condemning the death squads. He was outspoken in his criticism of the military, and also trying to help deal with cases where people had disappeared. Isn't that right?
Yes, that's very true. And I'm at present engaged in preparing the official version of all his sermons in English. And he devoted at least a quarter or a third of his sermon every single week to reporting on the abuses that had taken place during the past week and the number of people who had disappeared. And he gave their names and said their families were looking for them. And he spoke out very, very strongly about this. And that, I think, is one of the main reasons why the government felt that he had to be silenced. You probably remember that the last Sunday sermon he preached, he made a direct appeal to the soldiers in the army, the ordinary soldiers and the ordinary policemen, not to go on killing their comrades, not to do anything against the will of God, and to disobey the orders of their superiors and officials if they were told to do something against God's will. Well, that is a very strong appeal, and I think his enemies could not tolerate that and felt he had to be silenced. The other thing which he did, which caused enormous trouble to him, he condemned the United States for sending so much money to El Salvador, where the government was spending it all on arms, on helicopter gunships that they were using against the poor, against their own citizens. And he called on President Carter to stop sending this money. Well, that created a sensation, not only in El Salvador, but around the world.
I was speaking to Jesuit Father Michael Campbell Johnson. Sarah Smith Pierce is an expert on El Salvador at the Catholic Agency for Aid and Development, CAFOD, in London. She says Archbishop Romero is an outstanding example of Christian sacrifice, and that's why his legacy lives on so strongly, 30 years after his martyrdom.
For me, when I speak to people in El Salvador, Romero stands as a symbol of how to live a Christian life. And he stands as a symbol of bringing Christian values into action. There's something about what Archbishop Romero stood for and his courage to face the ultimate consequences. He knew that he was in grave danger, and yet he continued to speak out very courageously on behalf of people who were being killed or threatened. And it's something about the example of Christian sacrifice that Romero represents, which I think it touches a chord in people all over the world. His impact in El Salvador and across the world, in Christian communities across the world, is quite phenomenal.
That was Sarah Smith Pierce of CAFOD. Thursday is the Feast of the Annunciation, when the angel Gabriel visited Mary and revealed to her that she would become the mother of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. The feast is one of the most important in the church calendar and is celebrated on March the 25th each year. Monsignor Paul Tai is secretary of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications, and he spoke to me about the significance of this pivotal event in the history of the Church.
I suppose in many ways we're celebrating a feast that underlines two of the great events of our Christian story. It tells us about the Annunciation to Mary, of the fact that she would be mother of Jesus Christ. And then it also celebrates the incarnation of Jesus Christ. He becomes flesh in the womb of Mary. Therefore, it's a very pivotal feast in the life of the Church. In many ways, it's probably the nativity, the birth of Christ, Christmas, that gets the attention. But in some way, the story begins here in this very simple encounter of Our Lady and the angel who announces to Our Lady that she will be the mother of the Son of God. And she, in her generosity, says yes to that invitation, to that call.
In fact, the Gospel account sheds a lot of insight into the figure of Mary, doesn't it? I mean, what characteristics shine forth most clearly?
I mean, many people will automatically, and I think correctly, focus on the fact that Mary says yes to the invitation to be the Mother of God. But I think to jump to that yes too quickly would not be to do justice to Mary's own human reservations and nervousness about this great adventure she's taking on by accepting the invitation of the Lord to be the mother of his child.
She's actually quite surprised and confused, isn't she?
Absolutely surprised and confused. Some commentators have made a very interesting observation that many of the Bible stories of miraculous births and miraculous conceptions happen to women who've struggled with infertility. And this then is the realisation of their dreams to become a mother. Mary instead is a young child, really, by today's standards, somebody who has not known man, who has no expectation that she could become a mother, and who probably is facing also a realisation that this will not be a non-problematic pregnancy in the society in which she lives. And yet, with great generosity, she says yes to the invitation.
Now, the way that the angel Gabriel greets Mary forms the origin of many key prayers, doesn't it, in the church? Can you tell us something about that?
Many of the key prayers of the church are born out of this account. We have the Hail Mary, who was born from it, the prayer of the Angelus, and subsequently the Magnificat, where Mary realises that she is the one who has been blessed very particularly by God in being chosen. But I think for me the key thing is that is interesting is that Mary says yes, and yet when the angel greets her, he already says, Hail Mary, full of grace. So the grace and the strength and the faith with which she says yes is not her own achievement. It's something that's already been gifted to her by God. And yet her accepting of that, her accepting of the implication of that, is truly her own human choice. So we have this wonderful interplay that Mary could have done none of this without the grace, without the faith, which had been a gift from God. And yet, to some extent, the Christian story could never have happened without her free yes, without her free acceptance. So there's this wonderful interplay of the God who equips her with the grace and the strength to do what she wants to do, and yet the God who respects her freedom. I suppose the key thing, the other verse that I like, particularly in the Gospel passage, is that simple assurance, nothing is impossible to God. I think we often find ourselves in life faced with situations where we're inclined to think it's all impossible. There's no room for hope. There's no room for going forward. And I think that simple faith of Mary that says, no, nothing is impossible to God, that somehow in strange and extraordinary ways, God has a way of being present in very difficult situations, is I think something that's very reassuring in this feast and in this particular gospel reading.
Now, as we all know, Mary said yes, but she was also very joyful about it. And in fact, she realised the great honour that had been done to her. And this amazing hymn of praise, the Magnificat, which has been part of the church's liturgy of the hours at Vespers, I gather, for more than 1,000 years. Tell us something about this.
I think what that is a prayer is which Mary recognises, in a sense, her very privileged role. But she sees it all as the achievement of God, rather than as her own achievement. It's this wonderful, her own sense of the great privilege that has been done to her, the great trust that has been placed in her, blinds her to her own yes, to her own responsibility, to her own generosity, and her focus is exclusively on the greatness of God and the great things that he has done through her. I think another part of that story that is wonderful is the sense that when Mary hears this great news, her first concern is not for herself, but hearing also that her cousin Elizabeth is with child, she goes to be with her cousin, to share the good news, but also to be with her, to support her and to help her. And I think this is the key thing. It's all about Mary in the sense of being a person in service of others, giving her life for others, finding in the will of Christ the thing that makes her life worthwhile and valuable.
It's also amazing, isn't it, that God didn't choose some well-known lady, some rich lady. He went instead to a, you know, backwater town and chose this very young girl from an obviously fairly humble background.
Yeah, I think that's one of the extraordinary things. And it's a thing that I think one of the things that while this feast isn't necessarily one that is, you know, the top two or three celebrations in the annual life of the church, but it's an event and a feast that has captured the imagination, particularly of artists, because there's extraordinary human drama in this. You have this simple person taken from nowhere and is now about to become a pivotal figure in the history of salvation. And I think the great artists have captured that. Usually the interesting thing is that their depictions of the Annunciation happen in simple scenes of domesticity. It's something that's breaking God's power to break into the ordinary, into the everyday, and to surprise, is what's at the heart of this. I think that's something that the artists have above all intuited, and various artists, those of us who come from Ireland, grew up with the image from Fra Angelica as the Angelus was played on our television screens at 6 o'clock. The image of Fra Angelica's Annunciation was the image we saw first. But again, capturing images of a simple young girl being greeted by an angel against a domestic background, and this extraordinary event almost rendered commonplace because of the choice of God to choose somebody of great simplicity.
Do we know exactly when the Church's celebration of the Feast of the Annunciation dates from? Can you tell us a little bit more about its history?
There are feasts that seem very similar to it, celebrated from an early time in the life of the Church. I think most scholars would say with certainty that the feast as we know it today began to be celebrated around 430, 431, coinciding more or less with the Council of Ephesus. And it became the feast. The actual choosing of the date itself was quite interesting, is that the date of the 25th. There's a debate as to whether Christmas dating of the 25th of December comes from the prior dating of the Annunciation on the 25th of March, or vice versa.
Because they had to be 9 months between
them. Yeah, there was obviously the 9 month link. But very clearly, what's interesting too is that in the early church, there was a sense that this was the 25th of March, was all sorts of things coincided on that day. It was seen as the date of the creation of Adam. It was seen as the date in which Moses had crossed through the Red Sea. It was seen as the date of the death of Jesus. And therefore, it's very often the idea that great prophets would have come into the world on the anniversary of their death, or on the prior anniversary of their death. It was seen that therefore the 25th of March became the date to be associated with the Annunciation, and particularly with the Incarnation. So that date then became in many ways the beginning of the new year.
And in fact, for many, many centuries, perhaps some of our listeners wouldn't know this, New Year's Day was in fact celebrated on this day, wasn't it? March the 25th.
Yeah, New Year's Day was celebrated on the March the 25th. In England, it was known as Ladies' Day.
Why was it changed, do you know?
I'm not sure where the emergence came there, but I know that it was interesting that up until sometime in the 18th century, the legal year in Britain began on the 25th of March with the Ladies' Day. In the Curia, at one stage, there was a tradition that the year began with the beginning of the Incarnation feast. I presume it's one of these things that as the world became more standardised, that certain conventions emerged that the more standard understanding of New Year's Day on the 1st of January would have emerged. But what is also interesting was that in Germany and Austria, there were wonderful traditions where the Feast of the Annunciation was also known as the Feast of the Swallows, because that was the day the swallows were seen as coming back and marking the beginning of spring. So I think it's a wonderful feast that captures this sense of new life, new beginnings, new year at one stage, the spring, the swallows back, and maybe an invitation for us to begin that regeneration and re-life ourselves as we look forward to the great feasts of Christmas.
I was speaking there to Monsignor Paul Tai, Secretary at the Pontifical Council for Social Communications. As when you said yes to the angels. Well, that's all for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Susie Hodges. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can check out our website at any time on www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.